This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The issue of same-sex marriage has torn apart one of Bloomington's most prominent Protestant congregations.
There were certainly many people that are passionate on both sides of the issue, so there was going to be a fallout either way.
GLT's Judy Valente reports on why more than 100 members have left St. John's Lutheran Church and the lessons it holds for other Protestant denominations. Hear from two members of the newly seated Bloomington Public Safety and Community Relations Board. It's an effort to keep Bloomington from becoming the next Ferguson, Missouri. Ryan Denham has the interview. And it's a check-in with ISU President Larry Dietz about efforts to increase international student enrollment as the Trump administration tries to curtail immigration. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 18th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Church congregations across the country have periodically experienced conflict over scripture teaching and LGBT issues. Bloomington Normal is no exception. This year, one of Bloomington's most active congregations, St. John's Lutheran, lost about 10% of its members. GLT's Judy Valente reports on the issue that divided the congregation and the lessons the St. John's experience holds for other Protestant churches.
It's a Sunday morning service at St. John's Lutheran Church in Bloomington. About 200 people gather before a simple, unadorned altar to sing hymns, pray, listen to a sermon, and share communion in a long tradition of Lutheran worship. But something has changed at this sprawling stone church, known for its outreach to youth, the elderly, and the poor. The community of 1,300 is trying to heal. About 100 longtime members left St. John's earlier this year. The issue that divided the congregation? Same-sex marriage. The struggle began when a same-sex couple who had attended the church for years sought to marry there.
You know, they feel St. John's is their home, their church home, and while they had been together as a couple for a number of years, they wanted and desired to be married in their church.
That's Chris Magnuson, president of the St. John's Church Council. The council decided to allow the marriage. The decision sparked an intense debate within the congregation over what Scripture teaches about marriage.
There were certainly many people that are passionate on both sides of the issue, so there was going to be a fallout either way.
Those who left St. John's formed a new congregation, Faith Lutheran Church. They now worship in a meeting room in the Eastland Suites Hotel in Bloomington. The services at both churches are virtually identical. The theology is not.
How did this happen? Faith Lutheran Church of McLean County, how did this even happen?
That's Faith Church's pastor, Brian Gulk, who used to be the senior minister at St. John's. He left St. John's after its council decided to allow same-sex marriage at the church. He's heard here in a Facebook recording of his first sermon to his new congregation.
I'll tell you how it happened. There were a group of people in this community who experienced what Bill Hybels calls holy discontent. You were experiencing the Holy Spirit, and God was calling you to create something new.
Faith Church also broke with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, the national association of which St. John's is part. In a 2009 statement called Human Sexuality, Gift, and Trust, the Evangelical Lutheran Church permitted ministers in same-sex relationships to serve the church. The ELCA also leaves it up to individual congregations to decide whether to sanction same-sex marriages.
But we need a church that's different than every other church in the community. Not a church that does the same old, same old.
Faith Church is now part of an association called Lutheran Churches in Mission for Christ. It follows a more conservative theology, including the view that marriage should only be between a man and a woman. Goke describes the kind of congregation Faith Lutheran aims to be.
We're not just going to read God's word and ponder them. We're not going to just read God's word and think about them. We're not going to just read God's word and consider and say, hey, what do you think? We're going to read God's word and we're going to look each other in the eye and challenge one another to live into these words.
Many in the St. John's congregation see the issue differently. Council President Magnuson says the church wants to send a message of acceptance and inclusion, something St. John's members say is the heart of Christian teaching.
People interpret the Bible differently. There's respect for both points of view in terms of interpretation. Where it's kind of sad to me is where that divides us as Christians at a time when we really need to be reaching out and bringing people into the faith and not let us get pulled down by differences.
The St. John struggle is not unique. Randy Raisi, co-pastor of Calvary United Methodist Church in Normal, says despite decades of debate, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, and gender rights are still hot-button issues in many Protestant churches. The United Methodist Book of Discipline, which sets church teaching, says homosexual activity is, quote, incompatible with the Christian life. The church does not allow same-sex marriage or the ordination of openly gay ministers. Racy says that doesn't mean there's agreement among congregations.
Probably reflective of a lot of churches and denominations. We're torn by this issue, we're divided by this, and the practices aren't all the same, although we all, at least in name, adhere to the same book.
Some United Methodist ministers have performed same-sex marriages in defiance of the rules, and a gay woman married to her same-sex partner was elected a bishop in the United Methodist Church's Western Region last year. The Methodist Church faces a potential turning point in February 2019 when a special commission is scheduled to issue a report on sexual issues. Racy and his wife Debbie, who is co-pastor at Calvary United Methodist, say even they don't agree completely on these issues. Debbie Racy says disagreements over theology are nothing new.
Folks, we can disagree and still care about each other and still love each other. We can talk with one another. And that's what I think that's the message we want to send to everybody. Please don't vilify someone who has a different belief than you. Please get together and respectfully talk about that.
The St. John's experience holds potential lessons for other congregations. Council member Chris Magnuson says the church spent months deliberating before its governing council made a decision.
A lot of time was spent by council members and congregation members in prayer and discernment and, a very challenging issue, to really think about. You have people's lives who are impacted. And so a lot of thought went into that. And over several months period, was probably 6 to 8 months from the start of the process to when a decision was made.
Magnuson says about 70% of the feedback supported allowing the marriage to take place. Still, it wasn't an easy process. Magnuson says even the 13-member governing council was divided. Some in the congregation were dissatisfied with the council's vote. They demanded the issue be put to a congregation-wide vote. About 500 St. John's members showed up for yet another meeting.
The majority of the congregation, I guess if you were to summarize it, want to be welcoming and inclusive. It's not ours to judge.
The two members eventually wed at St. John's last fall. The couple did not respond to a request for an interview. Many Protestant denominations, like the Lutherans, operate under a decentralized administrative structure. This gives those congregations freedom on a grassroots level, but also opens the door for conflict.
The dilemma that our national church has felt is that they want to be supportive without being intrusive.
Lanny Westfall is now the interim senior pastor at St. John's Lutheran.
They offer resources. They offer study guides. This has been a subject of conversation for about 25 years.
Our lives as Christians are always under construction. God is always straightening us, leveling us, widening our outreach to reach a changing world.
Westfall advises churches facing similar divisions to engage in open and transparent discussion. Westfall says those kinds of deliberations are necessary within congregations, even if they are sometimes painful.
It is very important to have a lot of communication that is open and responsive, that demonstrates both what people are thinking and what the leadership is thinking about things, but also willing to listen to other people in a respectful way, and to have some education too.
Donations to St. John's have declined about 10%, and the church says it has had to trim its budget, but without curtailing its commitment to mission trips and community programs, such as the Safe Harbor Shelter and the Midwest Food Bank. Faith Church is trying to raise $180,000 in pledges in the coming year to continue ministries for children and the developmentally disabled that its members have been involved in. Magnuson of the St. John's Council says both congregations will face challenges ahead and need time to heal.
Well, there's certainly sadness. You know, I had good friends that left, and you're sad to see that happen. You respect their view, on the issue, and I greatly respect those who might have disagreed with the decision but continue to call St. John's home.
Magnuson recalls that at one time in its history, St. John's was deeply divided over another issue, whether services should be in English or remain in Swedish. The church eventually overcame that conflict. Debbie Reese, the co-pastor of Calvary Methodist, says other churches might see in the St. John's experience a cautionary tale.
It just makes us sad. You know, when any of the churches in town hurt, we hurt. All churches at some point deal with this. And so we are just praying ourselves up for that, all of us.
Westfall, the St. John's pastor, says he is optimistic the congregation will recover from the past year's turmoil. He has extensive experience serving congregations in crisis.
This congregation has a tradition of resiliency. They always make the choice to be more open and welcoming and inclusive, as Chris said. And people are talking about the fact that we want to embrace our identity, and we want to let everybody know that there is a place here for them, that the table is big enough to seat everybody who wants to be present.
Jesus has said.
Brian Goak, the pastor of Faith Lutheran, the church that broke with St. John's, tells his members he wants Faith Church to be known for what it is for, rather than what it is against.
This is going to be a church where discipleship is costly. Doing the hard work of what it means to go out into the world and not be popular, but to roll up our sleeves and get to work.
For the foreseeable future, the two Lutheran congregations seem unlikely to find common ground on sexual issues. They will continue to worship at the same time on Sunday mornings in different parts of town. I'm Judy Valente.
One area where St. John's Faith Lutheran churches do agree is on the importance of children's ministry. Here's the children's choir of St. John's singing the traditional African-American spiritual, Children Go Where I Send Thee.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, raising financial resources to increase the independence and dignity of women and girls in our community. More information about the Women to Women Giving Circle and more at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas coming up. One of our regular conversations with Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. Charlie Schlinker asks about Trump administration efforts to curtail immigration and the effect on ISU international student enrollment. The interview is ahead during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Officer-involved shootings have turned American cities like Ferguson, Missouri, into household names, shorthand for a community at war with its own police force. The city of Bloomington's new Public Safety and Community Relations Board is a preemptive strike against becoming the next Ferguson. The city council created the advisory board nearly 5 months ago. It held its first orientation meeting Wednesday. Members Art Taylor and Jeff Woodard are ready to go. Like the other five on the board, Taylor and Woodard bring a lifetime of experience to the table. GLT's Ryan Denham asked Taylor what they hope to accomplish.
The fact that we have had no incidences in Bloomington or Normal that rise to the level of what has happened in Ferguson and other locations, Rockford and some larger towns, is a testament to community interaction, not only with police, but with the community. I've always viewed this board as one of inoculation, to help prevent the measles you get and a measles inoculation, same with the chicken pox and things like that. And when we've developed dialogue that I participated in, I've helped facilitate, attended many meetings and gatherings here in the community to have discussions between the community and with the police. Those are all forms of inoculation that help have conversation between what may be seen as differing entities, when in fact we're all part of the same community. So the board that Jeff and I are about to set foot into, I think, is another opportunity for us to continue the dialogue.
Art, can you talk about your own history working in civil rights and how that informed your wanting to serve on this particular board?
Before I retired at State Farm, the last position that I held was that of Diversity and Inclusion Director for Claims Services, and that was an opportunity for me to share my passion for diversity and more inclusion than diversity, to include people in conversations that are sometimes difficult to have. So dialogue is something that I kind of focused on, particularly the tail end part of my career. I've been involved with some of the projects that Not in Our Town has been involved in, and of course, back in college, I was a student activist. But more than anything else, the positions that I've held in the business world lent itself to being the only. And when I say the only, that is what it meant. I would sometimes be the only African American manager or the only African American participant in a dialogue session that would give me the opportunity to share my experiences and to listen for the experiences of others to help encourage commonality and dialogue around difficult topics sometimes. And I always viewed my participation as one of education, as well as delivering experiences that others may not have had, and worked myself by a set of norms that would include listening and allowing others to share their stories, and for those stories to be true for them. And as part of what I hope to bring to the board is one of listening and one of participation and inclusion to make sure that others' voices are heard, as well as helping to bridge some gaps between understanding.
Are there experiences you've had in your own lives as it relates to interactions with law enforcement, traffic stops, stories from friends and family, that you'll draw on in some way to perform your work here with the board?
As a black male in my 50s, growing up in the city, I was born in Rockford, Illinois, I've had a lot of opportunities to be engaged with the local police department, and even in Bloomington Normal. I've been here 28 years, and some of those experiences have been great experiences, and some of them have not. So with that in mind, I think that I could be fair and impartial. Because I can see both sides, and even just recently, I sat down and had a conversation, unexpectedly, a great conversation with Sergeant Knowles of the Bloomington Police Department, and he shared some insight and some things that they're doing or planning to do that I'd had no idea they were doing. So, dialogue again, what Art was talking about, I think that is a big piece of that. I mean, we like to throw that around. The word dialogue, or as well as we do, the word diversity. You know, as an African American growing up, I think Art could probably agree with this. We don't grow up having to learn what diversity is. You know, we are diversity. So I think that puts us in a unique position to assist in any kind of conflict resolution, if need be, by the police department or anyone else in the community that may need our help or insight. And we'll do the same. Again, what Art said is it's about listening, and I think we can do that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've not had as many so-called run-ins with police, if you will. But my dad was a Chicago police officer for a long time when I was a kid. And in the so-called talk that children get, or African-American boys particularly get, from their parents to basically instruct them and to teach them and to help protect them, when you come into contact with police officers, I received that talk. And it was one of, you know, make sure that your hands are visible at all times, that you speak in tones that are not too aggressive, and don't make any fast moves, and answer the police officers' questions and whatnot. Well, growing up later on in life, and you start to think about that, and that talk that African American boys had to get in order to realize that they were different, and that somewhat and could be treated differently by police officers. Why was that talk necessary for us to get as kids and whatnot? And that's always stayed with me my entire life. In any of the encounters that I've ever had with police officers, be they on the highway when you get that speeding ticket or you have occasion to have conversations with police officers in their line of duty. Those lessons that my dad and my grandfather taught me when I was a kid always come back when I'm thinking about that. So those are things that have stayed with me for a very long time. And while I've not had the occasion to have difficult run-ins with police officers, I know that there are others who have. And I've had family members who have had difficulties with law enforcement and whatnot. And sometimes those opportunities turned out pretty good. Sometimes they didn't turn out so very good. And it always took me back to the lessons that my dad and my grandfather used to teach me in how you deal with situations where you're answering questions and whatnot.
Well, as it relates to the goals of the Public Safety and Community Relations Board, do you see this board as reacting to problems in the community with how Bloomington Police treats those it interacts with, or do you see it as a more of a proactive measure trying to get ahead of and maybe avoid some of the issues that have surfaced in other communities? Is it some mixture of both reactive and proactive? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I would say it's both, but at the center of it is, of course, it's an advisory position. And it gives us the opportunity, as Art said, to open up the discussion on where we're at as a community in terms of our education or our enlightenment in terms of how important it is for us to develop a relationship, and as well as, you know, as a respect for law enforcement. But it works both ways. You know, we expect the law enforcement to respect the citizen, but the citizen also has to do the same, and there's some things that we could probably do or some conversations that we can have within our own community where we see that there's issues or problems that could send us off in a direction. Just from a national standpoint, you know, we talk about here locally what's happening. We'll say, well, why is there a need for this? This is not Ferguson. This is not L.A., Detroit. There's a possibility that we could have an impact on heading off some issues and clarifying some misunderstandings along the way.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm in studio today with Art Taylor and Jeff Woodard, two members of Bloomington's newly appointed Public Safety and Community Relations Board. Some folks call it the Police Civilian Review Board. One of the board's official duties is going to be adding a resident perspective to the evaluation of civilian complaints, including the timely, fair, and objective review of those complaints. How does that actually play out, do you think? Do you review every complaint that comes in? Is it just only if a problem arises with the resolution of a certain complaint? How do you think that'll actually play out in practice?
You know, that's a good question. We haven't had our first organizational meeting yet, so as to the setting of bylaws and how the board will work to set up ground rules for how we will proceed, all of that is kind of fresh territory for us. So I feel a little uncomfortable trying to answer that question. What I envision, however, is our board being able to take complaints from citizens in the community when maybe an event or a stop or something maybe went the wrong way, and be able to process that and investigate and be able to bring some information to bear that could better answer that complaint. We are more of an advisory board, so we're not really into change police procedures or anything like that, but to help create better understanding of what those processes are in place and how they can best be communicated to the community for better understanding. I kind of see that as our role.
As you well know, collective bargaining agreements that cover the police department's employees limit like reinvestigations of civilian complaints and prohibit police officers from being compelled to testify in front of a civilian board like this. Do you think that the board will have enough teeth, enough power to actually make a difference if there's a really contentious case or complaint that comes up?
I think so. I think, as Art said, we need to be careful that we don't try to speak for the at this early in the process to try to speak for the entire process. But advisory, that's important. And when you start talking about changes in policy and procedure, I think it's up to the enforcement to have the teeth to see where there may be room for improvement and do that.
Sure.
And that's what we're hoping for.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. There's several well-known organizations in the community who wanted this reward. And that's how that kind of raised my attention to it, is that, hey, you know, there's a good number of community here that want to see this happen. And at the same time, there's a wave of anger, across the nation. And if we have an opportunity to quell some of that anger here locally, I think that'll go a long way. And I do realize people have questions, as well as we have questions. You know, what are they going to do? What's going to happen? And when it comes down to handling issues, when it comes in terms of the police union, I'm a 28-year union member myself. I come from a blue-collar family, AFL-CIO, IBEW. I understand how unions work, and there's just going to have to be that kind of back and forth that has to go on between the union and the police department themselves. Again, at this point, we're strictly in an advisory position, so I don't see that to be a hindrance to making a positive difference in the community. And again, like I said, if we can save one life of an officer or a civilian, I'm all for that.
That's Jeff Woodard and Art Taylor, two members of the newly appointed Bloomington Public Safety and Community Relations Board. I'm Ryan Denham.
The other five members of Bloomington's new Public Safety and Community Relations Board are Robert Bosquez, Sally Rudolph, Jan Lancaster, William Bennett, and Serena Fish. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Stories continue to mount about Trump administration efforts to deny entry of foreign nationals into this country. But Illinois State University President Larry Dietz says that's not yet had a big impact on the size of the contingent of foreign national students. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Dietz says this comes at a time when ISU is trying to increase its count of international students.
Of the countries that have been named, we haven't been doing a lot of work in those countries anyway, and so we really have not seen an impact on that other than increasing some anxiety of some students who are here and wondering about going home and those kinds of things. But overall, we are only at 2% of our entire population are from other countries, so our numbers are very small, and we don't have a desire to get up anywhere around, some other sister institutions that have very high percentages or higher percentages than we do. So we're going to be, again, doing kind of a steady Eddie approach to this. And so the students that we've talked to, they still want to come to the United States. They still want to pursue an education here. An education from the U.S. is highly valued, and I don't think that we're having the kind of issues that some other places do.
Is the general climate, though, of the administration's policy toward immigrants causing some of the students to say, I would like a U.S. education, but if I'm looking for that to turn into a job, perhaps I should look at Europe instead?
Well, there's always been a dynamic issue with international students. The UK has been very aggressive as a country for international students. Australia and New Zealand have also been very aggressive. But I would say that the quality issue for the United States is really a very positive one, and that our reputation in both undergraduate and particularly in graduate higher education has been one that people from all over the world hope that they can have access to and get a degree in, and that will help them in the job market. So I would say, we've got to continue to work to counter the mystique out there that we're still not a welcoming country, and we are welcoming institutions within the United States, and I think that's the most important part.
On the international student recruitment front, you recently made a trip to China. What did that result in?
Well, it was a very focused trip. We went to two institutions. One was Southwest University in Chongqing. I'd never been there before. It's the largest city in all of China, which is really saying something. They have 32 million people in that city, and Southwest University has a lot in common with Illinois State University, and they've already committed to sending a number of faculty members here for, matter of fact, starting next month, who will be here for a while, working with our faculty across a number of disciplines. And so we're excited about that. The other institution that we visited was Tsinghua University in Shanghai. And they have an interest in what we will call a 2+2, which generally oftentimes means that students will spend a couple of years at the institution in China, come here and wrap up degrees here in the remaining 2 years. So they have a number of students that are interested, particularly in the College of Fine Arts, and that number is expanding to some of our other colleges as well. And so they're interested in them having an international experience, and that international experience at Illinois State. So it's very fruitful, and we're looking forward to working with those two institutions in the future.
How many kids do you think you'll get out of that agreement?
The initial conversation is 100. And again, that will be about 20 a year for several years as a ramp up to about 100.
And put that in scale with the other international population on campus now, would you?
Well, we're working on the other international populations, too. So, China obviously is the most populous country in the world. But our international program is going to be diverse, and we will have more Chinese in that program. But we're also going to have students from other parts of the world, too. I just met this last week with folks that are coming in from Panama. And so we're looking really at all the continents, not just one.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with ISU President Larry Dietz, as we do from time to time. The Harvey Weinstein effect in the national moment and national conversation has been pronounced, and we're starting to see that trip over into higher education. In Hollywood, there are, of course, power differentials between studio heads and actors and actresses and directors and cast members. And in higher education, there is certainly a power differential between students and professors. It's not a new issue. Is it rising in prominence even in higher education because of this moment?
You know, I was talking with our director of the Office of Equal Opportunity just the other day about this, and we have not seen a spike in complaints. There is a lot more conversation about this issue, and I think it's a societal issue that permeates our entire society. We've not seen any kind of spike in complaints, but I know that the rhetoric is getting a lot more heated. The number of individuals at national levels are really affecting, I think, the national commentary around this. And so we have a number of protocols in place that, and through our orientation programs, we'll talk to faculty and particularly new faculty and their orientation about the importance of maintaining some distance between themselves and their students, still being interested in their intellectual development, but not pressing the personal part to the point where anybody is feeling feeling harassed or feeling this power differential. I'd say it exists, but I would also say that I think it's a really good thing that there are a lot of people that are coming out of the woodwork. I think it's healthier for those individuals who may have repressed this for many, many years. And that rhetoric is being very positive on the campus and well-received by the students. And so we've not seen a big uptick, but we've seen an uptick in the conversation. I think that's very healthy.
Do you think there will be an uptick? Since there in politics and in the entertainment industry, there has been apparently this undercurrent for decades that has not been addressed.
Yeah, I don't. I wouldn't put academia in the same realm.
Why not?
As entertainment and politics.
Human beings are essentially messy, though.
That's right.
What distinguishes academia from those other two platforms?
Well, I just think it's a higher level of conversation that happens in the classroom. I'm sure, many institutions in the country have had instances, particularly in the past, of a professor dating a student, whether they did that while they were in a class with them, or they were doing that, after the class was over, and probably some marriages have. I know some folks that have marriages that have come out of that. But it's a different situation now, and I think folks are a lot more careful about what they're doing with that. And so I don't see the uptick, again, in the number of complaints. I have seen an uptick in the conversation, and I think that uptick is very, very good. Many of our students, and I was meeting with some of our student leaders the other day, and our student athletes organization, the head of that is a young man who is also leading a charge of with the It's On Us campaign, which is basically that there needs to be a lot of education and a lot of attitude change on the part of young men and young women, for that matter, to talk about issues before those issues become something that neither party may have agreed to. And so communication is a critical part of all this.
What are the institutional safeguards that ISU has in place to try to address and prevent this issue?
We have a number of protocols. Matter of fact, some of our policies, we have one that goes all the way back to 2002, so this is not a recent thing at all. But part of our language and Our consensual relations and instructional settings policy talks about the faculty members have an ethical obligation not to initiate nor enter into consensual amorous, romantic, and or sexual relationships with students or others during the time that the faculty member is in a position to evaluate or supervise the partner in the relationship, and also that faculty members should be aware that there can be a perception of subtle yet powerful elements of coercion even in apparently consensual relationships, and as a result, such relationships are particularly vulnerable to charges of sexual harassment. And so this policy goes on for about another page and a half, and I won't read all of that. But I think
thank you.
But I think, you know, having some policies, making people aware of those policies, and we do that in orientation sessions and in other ways, I think really helps to educate.
You know, human resources departments didn't stop Charlie Rose or Matt Lauer from happening. Do policies like this, can they really prevent problems from happening, particularly at the graduate student level where a student may be fully committed to an area of research or scholarship and there's only one or two professors on any campus that are able to address that need or that desire? I mean, they're going to be, in raising objections, it should the objections be needed, they're going to be putting their future at risk.
Right, right. Well, I think it goes back to the point that you made and that human beings are messy. And is there a possibility that, you know, the instances that you mentioned at the national level could happen on a college campus or our college campus? And the answer to that is that there's always a possibility. But I do think that the most important thing we can do, we can't follow either students or the faculty or staff members around all the time, and we wouldn't want to do that. But by the same token, I think the most important thing we can do is to let people know what the parameters are, educate them about that, and be available to individuals who have felt that they have been harassed in some way, shape, or form, and respond to those kind of allegations very quickly and take action as quickly as we can after we've investigated that. And we're prepared to do that investigation and to take action quickly if, in fact, that we find that our policies have been violated.
You said there's been no uptick so far at ISU. What is the average? I mean, it happens from time to time. How often does it happen that things are reported?
Yeah, I don't have those numbers with me today. It's not I would say it's not the large numbers. I mean, if we had large numbers, it would be a different thing. But to me, it's not the numbers as much as it is the individuals, because all those numbers represent specific individuals with concerns, and we want to make sure that we handle each of those in a professional, caring way, and also we want to make sure that individuals who maybe have allegedly been harassing someone, we want to make sure that there's some protections on that side as well. So, and that's what the investigation does. Our new director of OEOA, Tony Walesby, is a national expert in this field and Title IX issues. And we also have provided him some additional funding for programming and awareness, not only on this topic, but other issues related to his office. So you can never do enough, but we're doing more than we've done previously.
Which brings up the idea that the administration bears some responsibility for fostering and promoting the conversation that you say is on the uptick. What more does Tony plan to do, or does the rest of the campus plan to do in a formal structured way?
Well, again, there's programming. We're in the middle of an academic year, and we oftentimes will bring in a few new folks in the middle of the year. Generally, the larger numbers come in the fall, obviously, and so this has become a part of our orientation programming for new faculty and staff. We also talk about it to our students in the open houses and preview programs that we have for students. And so I think making everybody aware, regardless of the role they're playing in the institution, is a big deal. And Tony and his staff have really done a good job of that.
ISU President Larry Dietz spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. Dietz says he's also relieved a proposal to tax graduate student tuition waivers has not made it into the final version of the GOP tax bill Congress will vote on later this week. Dietz says the next legislative threat to colleges and universities is pending in the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. He says there's a proposal to change the interest deferment on student loans. Currently, interest rates are deferred until graduation. Dietz says charging interest while a student is still in school would hurt the ability of students to afford an education. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The new year is looming. Are you looking for a great resolution? How about teaming up with your child to give back to the community and help some homeless pets at the same time? Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Humane Society of Central Illinois offers a variety of ways to be of service. If a youngster in your life is interested in doing some good in the community, there are opportunities galore at the Humane Society. Another way to help out the community is by not adding to the pet overpopulation problem. That's why the organization hosts monthly spay and neuter clinics for dogs and puppies and a low-income spay-neuter clinic for cats. That one occurs several times a month, says Development Director Madonna Courtright, because there's such a big need.
People who have lower incomes, cats are far less expensive to care for, but they still can have a pet and have that emotional support and something to cuddle and love with. But they need to get them taken care of. Individuals that receive any kind of government aid, such as WIC, LINC, that if they have a medical card, a Social Security insurance, or an unemployment benefits documentation of that would qualify.
Where do the clinics take place?
Well, the cats and kittens are taken care of at the Humane Society.
Oh, just right there in Normal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, we have a vet that is with us part-time, and she takes care of that for us.
So this is a very, very popular thing that you're offering the community. Do people have to reserve in advance a space in this clinic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this fills up so fast. It's one of those things, if you want to take advantage of this, you need to contact the office, find out when the next available time is, and get your name on the list. It's very important to do that and get that paperwork filled out.
So getting our dogs and our cats spayed and neutered and getting their rabies shot, a great way to show them that we love them by taking care of them. But what are other ways we can show our love for animals here in the community? I know that the Humane Society has opportunities for young people to get involved and volunteer and help out. So Madonna, let's talk about that. What sort of volunteer opportunities are there for young people, like, say, a 12-year-old girl who loves animals? What could she do for the Humane Society?
Pretty much anything that any of the volunteers can do. She just can't come by herself. She has to come with an adult. She also has to go through training. Anybody that volunteers with us has to go through our hour-and-a-half training program. So once they do that, they understand what's needed at the facility, how to handle the animals. We give them tours of the facility so they can easily find their way around.
So let's talk about some specifics. I think something a lot of kids would want to sign up for is walking dogs.
Well, walking dogs is something everybody wants to do, and that's one of the interesting things. People go through the training, and they have a very romanticized concept of working at the Humane Society with lots of loves and cuddles and petting and walking dogs and things like that. And that stuff happens.
Absolutely.
Is a very, very small part of what really goes on.
Because cat litter needs to be changed.
Oh, there's a lot of domestic chores that need to happen, which are not quite so glamorous.
Cleaning windows, maybe?
That we need cleaning windows, we need sweeping and mopping, we need someone doing laundry and folding towels, and you know, yeah, there's a good chance they're going to have to touch poop at some point.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no. Because it's there, and mm-hmm. it needs to go away.
Madonna, tell me why it's good for young people to volunteer for the Humane Society. What does that do for them?
Just giving them exposure to the animals is good. The animals themselves can be a good emotional support and may give them a sense of understanding and love. A big thing, some people cannot have pets. They live in apartments that don't allow animals, or there's a family member who may be allergic, or it's just not feasible to have a critter in the house. So this is a wonderful outlet for them to come and spend time with the animals. It's a good exposure.
That's Madonna Courtright, Development Director for the Humane Society of Central Illinois. The next low-income spay-neuter clinic for cats and kittens is coming up Tuesday, January 9th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
College-age students can also help out at the Humane Society. The organization offers internships for college students interested in communication and marketing. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Charlie Schlinker. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.